Good afternoon. Welcome to this month's edition of our University Colloquium. I'm very happy to introduce our speaker for this month. Dr. Joan Griffing is a professor and chair of the music department here at EMU. She's been on the faculty at EMU since 1996. She did her bachelor and her master's work in violin performance at Indiana University. And as you may be aware, that's one of the top music programs in the country, hard to get into. And then she did her doctoral work at The Ohio State University. So during the Q&A, if you've got any questions about Big Ten football, I'm sure she'd be happy to address those. In addition to all her teaching and faculty work here at EMU, she has a really impressive record of performance involvement. She's a founding member of Musica Harmonia, did I pronounce that correctly? A really great string quartet that does some interesting work both with classical repertoire and with new music. She's a member of the Virginia Symphony Orchestra and has done recording with that group, and she's also concertmaster of the Shenandoah Valley Symphony Orchestra. And most important for our purposes, she's the concertmaster of the Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival every summer. And so we get to hear her perform both solos and in the orchestra every summer. More recently, she's been working on issues related to how music and peace building might interrelate. And she's going to be talking to us today about results of her sabbatical work in New Zealand, the role of music in peace and conflict. I know I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. So welcome.
Thank you. Well, I didn't know Big Ten football might come up in this presentation, but I will just say that I enjoyed attending many Ohio State football games with my father when the coach was Woody Hayes, if anybody remembers that football coach from the old days. First of all, I'd just like to thank Fred and Deirdre and the administration for offering the opportunity for sabbatical. It's such a wonderful opportunity for enrichment, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity. So, kia ora. Welcome to today's presentation on the role of music in peace and conflict issues. I spent my sabbatical in the fall of 2013 in New Zealand because I was intrigued by the status of the relationship between the indigenous people, the Maori, and the settler society, the Pākehā. I spent 3 months in Dunedin at the University of Otago, where I was jointly sponsored by the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies, and we have the co-founder of that institution here, Vernon Jancy, and the music department. The other month and a half was spent traveling throughout the country. From research done here at home beforehand, it appeared that the Kiwis were further ahead in peace building in their society than were people from other countries around the world where conflicts between the old and new residents exist. As is perhaps not unusual for sabbaticals, I learned a great deal about my chosen topic, but I also made some interesting discoveries in areas I didn't expect. My research topic opened the door to a whole host of other areas related to my proposed study and questioned some of my assumptions. This statement is from the New Zealand Peace and Conflict Studies Center Trust. The nonviolent resolution of conflict is one of the greatest challenges of the 21st century. Serious levels of violence continue in our society and the world. Interpersonal violence, aggression between ethnic and religious groups, heightened international tensions, attacks on civilians, interstate conflicts and civil wars, increased incidents of government breakdown, and rapid growth in the number of refugees and displaced people. Here are two quotes that describe the formidable yet critical job of ahead for anybody working for peace. Some of you may be familiar with the organization Playing for Change. They have produced music videos with musicians from around the world to spread the message of peace among all people. Many of these songs are on YouTube and have been widely viewed, impacting a tremendous number of people. I was fascinated with how modern technology was making it possible to bring people together through music in this way. So I'd like to play one of the videos, just a short part of it, produced by Playing for Change. This song is Stand By Me.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point, you're gonna need somebody to stand by you.
So what other positive creative methods were musicians employing to influence and impact society? This was one question I wanted to address. As I began to talk to my colleagues about the role of music in peace and conflict issues, I received a great deal of encouragement to undertake a study in this area. John Paul Lederach wrote in support of my proposal, "Perhaps one of the most significant areas of growth in peace building in the past few years connects the processes of constructive change to the arts. It has been underexplored and researched, but now is coming into its own. Music, we are increasingly finding in neurological and social science research, is embedded much more deeply in the human experience and DNA than we have traditionally understood. This relates strategically to all facets and points in the wider conflict transformation spectrum of activities and challenges, from how we deal with healing to the expressive aspects of how groups find points of commonality and resonance needed to both engage, transform, and emerge from violence." He concluded, "We need many of these kinds of approaches and experiments." So the first question I thought that needed to be addressed was, how do we really know what role music plays in the human experience? Is it just a pleasant, feel-good, but inconsequential part of people's lives? It certainly is ubiquitous, but do people like music simply as a diversion to life's challenges and concerns? Daniel Levitin's fascinating book, This Is Your Brain on Music, asks and definitively answers these questions. From a neuroscientist's point of view, the jacket of the book makes this statement. Some leading experts have long held that music is a decoration, living parasitically on the fringe of human nature. On the contrary, Levitin argues and convincingly demonstrates that it is an obsession at the heart of human nature, perhaps even more fundamental to our species than speech. Inside the book, you learn about how music affects the brain. This is a photo of a brain on music, so all the different parts of the brain that are lit up. Levitin writes, "We finally gotten to the point where we can pinpoint specific areas of the brain that are involved in particular aspects of music processing. The human brain is divided into four lobes, the frontal, temporal, parietal, and occipital, plus the cerebellum. Musical activity involves nearly every region of the brain that we know about, and nearly every neural subsystem. There is no single music center. Rather, there are regions that perform component operations and other regions that coordinate the bringing together this information. Levitin discusses in detail how humans experience music, how composers take advantages of the way our brains regulate emotion, what the origins of music are, and why music plays such a unique role in our lives. Now that we know why music is important to us, what exactly do we mean by music? Here's a definition most people would agree with. Going beyond a definition, anthropologist and ethnomusicologist John Blacking states, the function of music is to enhance in some way the quality of individual experience and human relationships. Its structures are reflections of patterns of human relations, and the value of a piece of music is inseparable from its value as an expression of human experience. Swedish music pedagogy professor Göran Folkstad describes music this way. Music is and always has been an important part of human life. It can enable people to make daily work easier, to celebrate and dance, to protest against oppression and to establish contact with the gods, to tell the history of the past and to dream about the future, to encourage the fighter and to calm the worried, to shout out pain and bring messages of love, to keep weariness away and to make babies fall asleep. I will now address the other branch of my research, peace and conflict, because I believe the term peace building most accurately fits the role music can play in this in peace and conflict issues. I will shift to using that terminology. Here's a definition of peace building by the United Nations Peace Building Support Office. Some statements by Catherine Morris, the founder of Peacemakers Trust, a Canadian nonprofit organization for education and research in conflict resolution and peace building, do seem to indicate a place for music at the peace building table. She writes, a great deal of human suffering is linked to violent conflicts, political instability, or unjust policies and practices. Short-term humanitarian relief and crisis intervention, while important, are not enough in conflicted or post-conflict societies. There's increasing awareness of the need for post-conflict reconciliation, development of capacity for conflict resolution, and the building of sustainable peace. Peace building involves a full range of approaches, processes, and stages needed for transformation toward more sustainable, peaceful relationships and governance models and structures. I found these descriptions encouraging about a place for music in the field of peace building. By living in New Zealand for 4.5 months, I learned a great deal about the complexity that is the reality of a multicultural nation. For my research, I interviewed a whole host of people, both Maori and Pākehā, from Auckland to Dunedin. These people were connected in some way with the New Zealand justice system, peace organizations, Maori community, and/or current musical scene from academic, composition, and performance standpoints. I wanted to get an accurate understanding of the present state of affairs in order to draw some conclusions. I think in total I interviewed about 28 people. My purpose in taking up this topic was not necessarily to prove a thesis, but to undertake exploratory research. My interview questions were broad and invited a variety of perspectives. I was particularly interested in personal stories that related to my topic. One of the initial unexpected comments that arose was, can music really play a role in peace building? Interestingly, I heard this skepticism only from Pākehā, not from Maori. For the latter, the role was readily understood, if not named, because of the importance of music in their culture. I decided I need to identify some commonalities between music and peace building. They could serve as a basis for linking the two and provide a framework for intentional linking in the future. Indeed, I discovered a treasure trove of such commonalities. The first commonality is human connection through communication. New Zealand is internationally respected as one of the first countries in the world to introduce restorative justice, and one of the first to recognize it in law. Restorative justice is defined as a form of criminal justice that attempts to repair the damage caused by crime, either materially or symbolically. It is a victim-offender reconciliation movement where the victim and offender are voluntarily brought face-to-face. Family group conferences in the youth justice system were introduced in New Zealand in 1989. They bring families, victims, families, and offenders together so young offenders can face up to what they have done, apologize, and start to repair the damage by reparation through community work. One of the main proponents and leaders of this program in New Zealand is retired District Court Judge Fred McElroy of Auckland. He told me the success of restorative justice is based on the individual's experience of, perhaps for the first time, the other person's viewpoint, and in the specific case of the offenders, hearing firsthand the consequences of their actions on the victim's life. Communication is key to making human connections in restorative justice. Communication is an important aspect of music as well. In Maori culture, waiata, or songs, communicate a whole host of topics because their society was originally based on an oral tradition. Information was passed from one generation to another through chant and song. These waiata related information on geography, history, food preparation, planting instructions, genealogy, and many other topics. Waiata are used to welcome visitors to the marae, or Maori traditional meeting houses, and are integral part of hui, or meetings, which are sometimes held between dissenting tribes to resolve contentious issues. Kim Workman, of Ngāti Kanununu and Rangitane descent, who had a long career in law enforcement, described to me the impact of song in these settings on him as a child. Because waiata was and still is an indispensable part of Maori culture, it was an activity that everyone participated in. Singing was not undertaken by only a select few who had talent, but by every member of the iwi or tribe. It is just as much a part of being human as walking or talking. A graduate student at the University of Otago Peace and Conflict Center relayed to me her personal story of the meaning of waiata. Growing up in the Pākehā public school system, she was told that she did not have musical ability and therefore could not participate in her school's choral program. Although she loved to sing as a child, this pronouncement caused her to stop singing altogether. As she began to be in touch with her newly discovered Maori heritage as a young adult, she learned that song was of the breath. It is sacred as it connects us to the Creator. The breath, and therefore singing, is natural and life-giving for every human being. The young woman was able to gradually overcome her belief that she could not sing and eventually developed a strong singing voice. John Blacking, anthropologist and ethnomusicologist, writes, "Music is a fundamental channel of communication. It provides a means by which people can share emotions, intentions, and meanings, even though their spoken language may be mutually incomprehensible. It can also provide a vital lifeline to human interaction for those whose special needs make other means of communication difficult. Music can communicate feelings and emotions that may be difficult to express in words. Songs from the Inside is a television series produced by Maori actor and television producer Julian Arahanga for Maori Television. Four professional Maori singer-songwriters went into two New Zealand prisons to teach inmates how to write their own songs. In one of the episodes, one of the professional songwriters stated that the ability to communicate through music is an important part of why he turned to songwriting. He said, "Language is powerful. If I can't say out loud what I want, I might never achieve or receive or achieve my dreams. If I'm quiet, it's like the saying, to stand is to live, to sit and wait is to die." He was finally able to express himself through song lyrics. Songs from the Inside is a powerful example of how music can give people the tools to communicate with others in a new and positive way. Here's an excerpt from the television series from the final episode.
Tomorrow, I'm going to be released from my Rumataka jail. I've done my full time. If it wasn't for this production and this unit, I probably would try anything to try and stay in here, because it's been my home for a long time. It's been my home.
Freedom with you.
It's called institutionalized. Your family don't want to know you, you want shits on you, so you might as well stay here. But coming to this unit, that whole thing gets squashed and taken away. And you fellas just topped it off. This whole project, the whole journey. Look at it, I'm going home tomorrow. What a massive send-off.
I'm speaking for myself, but I'm also speaking for the brothers as well, who were missing their children. I didn't do it for fame, I didn't do it just to jump on TV, I've done it for my children. And I also done it for the brothers' children out there as well, you know. I'm actually representing brothers who are incarcerated.
The use of songs to communicate social injustices and protests has been a popular tool for demonstrators in New Zealand, as well as a way to establish unity among the group. Protest songs came to the forefront with Maori through reggae in the early 1970s and later through rap music. One person I interviewed participated in the 1975 Land March in the North Island and still recalls the songs that were sung in that march. One Dunedin interviewee recalls singing songs while marching in the streets as part of a protest against the Springbok Tour in 1981, when Kiwis protested the South African rugby team's discrimination of black players. Here's an example of a protest song from 1985 by the reggae band Herbs, speaking out against the use of nuclear power. Music can be a vehicle to speak truth to power, to communicate dissatisfaction with the political system, and to make satirical statements about the establishment. A prime example of that application of music is University of Otago music professor Graham Downes' alternative rock band, The Verlaines. Graham also holds a PhD in music history and is a University of Otago music department's Mahler specialist. So that was kind of an interesting juxtaposition. Empathy and a whole host of other human feelings can be communicated through music. New Zealand hymn composers are well known internationally for their tremendous output of hymns addressing social justice, peace and diversity, probably more so than any other nation. Colin Gibson, emeritus professor of English literature at the University of Otago and prolific hymn writer, said this in an address to the 75th anniversary conference of the Hymn Society of Great Britain and Ireland in 2011. New Zealand hymn writers continue to create new social justice hymns, believing that at the very least they may sensitize a congregation to the real social justice issues in the world around them. They may serve to open up debate and challenge fixed positions. They can attract the attention of young people with their relevance or their passion. They may serve to focus the singer's minds on a topical theme developed by the preacher. They sometimes inspire others to go into action beyond the walls of the church. They may encourage faith and hope in a more just future, and in this hope, New Zealanders continue to set forth a vision of justice exercised in this world as it is now. Music is a useful tool to communicate knowledge, to educate both young and old alike. One example of this is the piece you heard when you came in today, Anthony Ritchie's orchestral work, Remember Parihaka. As a young person growing up in New Zealand, Anthony was not taught in school the history of what happened to a tribe of Maori living in Parihaka in 1881. Led by Te Whiti and Tohu, Maori employed passive resistance against the government troops that were trying to take their land by force. Instead of taking up arms, the Maori plowed the fields, built fences, and planted crops. When the troops arrived to take the land, they were greeted by Maori women and children singing and offering gifts of flowers and food. Unfortunately, the troops were not deterred and confiscated the land. Many Maori men from Parihaka were imprisoned throughout New Zealand. Anthony stumbled across this part of New Zealand history while living in Dunedin and inquiring about the metal doors in the cliffs near Anderson's Bay. Some Maori from the Parihaka incident were imprisoned in cells behind those doors and died there. The orchestral work Anthony composed brings to light this incident in New Zealand history, effectively educating others who may not have been aware of it. Two well-known New Zealand singers with Maori ancestry, Moana Maniapoto and Whirimako Black, have taken it upon themselves to encourage the learning of Maori language through music. Whirimako told me she hopes her songs will empower Maori to learn the language and not be afraid of it. As an important part of Maori heritage, the language is crucial to keeping their culture alive. This 1991 song by Moana and the Moa Hunters communicates this important message.
Their stories were told in carving, song, and dance.
Learn about yourself, your history.
Ty Black, professor at Te Putai Atoi School of Maori Studies at Massey University, Palmerston North, has been active in bringing Waiata as a primary source of historical significance into the Pākehā courts. He believes strongly in the phrase, the lore of the land should become the law of the land. Some Waiata have effectively been used as evidence in legal proceedings on property rights and past grievances. These many examples of communication through music make the case for the first commonality with peace building. The second commonality is the importance of personal relationships. In her book, The Little Book of Strategic Peacebuilding, Lisa Sherrick writes, peacebuilding empowers people to foster relationships at all levels that sustain them and their environments. A current PhD student I met at the University of Otago National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies, Ellen Funari, wrote a paper titled, It's About Relationships More Than Weapons. Frontline Peacekeepers Define Effective Peacekeeping. She states, the frontline peacekeepers understood peacekeeping to take place within and through relationships, along a continuum of cooperative, trusting, mutually beneficial relationships. Ralph Bathurst, senior lecturer in management and leadership at Massey University Albany campus Auckland, works with recovering alcoholics in a recovery program on a volunteer basis. He told me that music helps him to relate to the participants in the program, thereby allowing them to trust him and be open to receiving his support. By playing in a band with the attenders every week and sharing the experience of making music together, he's able to build relationships with people he otherwise would have difficulty establishing trust. Maori Kim Workman is the director of Rethinking Crime and Punishment in Wellington, a strategic initiative to raise the level of public debate about the use of prison and alternative forms of punishment in New Zealand. He worked early on in his career as a police officer and later as an administrator in the Department of Justice, overseeing a reform of the penal system. He related stories to me of playing with jazz groups in schools and prisons in order to build relationships with the young people he would be working with in these settings. Music helped to establish himself as a friend, as a trusted individual, rather than just another member of the justice system. Another creative tool for building relationships through music is designing a safe environment for people of different cultures and/or backgrounds to work together in ways that are meaningful to them. Anthony Ritchie's oratorio, Ahua, is a prime example of just that. It was commissioned as part of the celebration of the anniversary of the arrival of the settlers in Otihai, or Christchurch. The work tells the story of Moki, one of the first Ngāi Tahu tribe to settle in the South Island. Anthony composed the music for the cantata, and the Maori author Kerry Huom wrote the libretto. The performers included both Maori and Pākehā musicians, and the work combined elements of both Western and Maori music. The time the musicians spent working and performing side by side enabled them to get to know each other and build relationships. The work also honored Maori heritage by bringing the history of the indigenous people from the local area to the forefront and to a largely Pākehā audience. Building positive relationships is an essential component of the human experience, and specifically Maori family life, as well as a necessary ingredient in successful peace building. The third commonality between music and peace building is identity and sense of place. Peace builders John Paul and Angie Lederach state, place provides a sense of location, belonging, and connection. With it, one finds oneself and recreates meaning and a sense of belonging. In her master's thesis from 2004 entitled The Roots of Roots Reggae in New Zealand, The Musical Construction of Place and Identity, the University of Otago music lecturer Jennifer Cattermole describes how New Zealand reggae musicians have used roots reggae to construct their own senses of place and cultural identity. She states, New Zealand reggae musicians have used roots reggae to overcome their sense of cultural dislocation, marginalization, and demoralization by ideologically relocating themselves to their perceived ancestral homelands and by creating both real and imagined communities at a range of different geographical scales. The reggae song Maranga Aka Ai from 1984 encouraged young Maori to take pride in their identity. An excerpt of the lyrics reads, all my life I get taught by the right of the right, all my life I get taught by the right of the great white way. How much longer before we get up and say, what's my freedom from oppression? Because that's what my people need. This song was banned from mainstream radio stations because many Pākehā found it offensive. Ake ai. In the book Musical Identities, Göran Folkstad writes, "Music has always played an important role in forming the identities of individuals and of groups of people. It provides a means of defining oneself as an individual belonging to and allied with a certain group, and of defining others as belonging to other groups which are separate from one's own." Sociomusicologists David Hebert and P.S. Campbell state, "Among all of the activities humans possess as means by which to create such a powerful sense of identity and community, music may be among the most personal and the most meaningful." In one episode of Songs from the Inside, an inmate clearly understood music as a way to help her find a sense of self and place. She said, "I write my songs to express who I am, what I believe, and where I come from, my origins." Professor Ty Black told me that for many Maori, music is about identity, a place to stand in the world. Although it serves in many capacities, he believes music's ability to define identity is one of its most critical roles in contemporary Maori society. The fourth commonality is tolerance and respect for others. In her book, Ritual and Symbolic and Symbol and Peacebuilding, Lisa Shirk states, "Peacebuilding encourages respect for and recognition of other human beings and empowerment of individuals to manage conflict peacefully." These concepts are important to musicians too. The book Parallels and Paradoxes is a series of conversations between close friends Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim. Edward Said was a cultural critic, academic, and writer. He served as professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. He was also an accomplished amateur pianist. Said's worldview was Palestinian. Daniel Barenboim is a concert pianist and former conductor of the Chicago Symphony and Deutsche Staatsoper in Berlin. He holds a Jewish worldview. Not only were Said and Barenboim close personal friends, they also collaborated on a significant project. On the 250th anniversary of Goethe's birth, in a city closely associated with Goethe, Weimar, Germany, they brought together Arab and Israeli musicians to play as one orchestra. Goethe wrote a collection of poems based on his enthusiasm for Islam, the West Eastern Divan. Barenboim and Said created the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. In the two men's conversations, Said said to Barenboim, "One of the striking things about the kind of work you do is that you act as an interpreter, as a performer, an artist concerned not so much with the articulation of the self, but rather with the articulation of other selves. Our experience in Weimar was all about a voyage to the other and not concentration on oneself." People's histories are complex things involving ideas of justice and injury and oppression. I don't think it's necessary that everyone should agree, as long as there's a mutual acknowledgement that a different view exists. We must have respect for each other's views and tolerate each other's histories. The ideas of tolerance and respect of others can be found in the New Zealand music education system. I discovered this statement in the New Zealand music curriculum from 2007. "Music is a fundamental form of expression, both personal and cultural. Music is placed upon the musical heritages of New Zealand's diverse cultures, including traditional and contemporary Maori musical arts. By making, sharing, and responding to music, students contribute to the cultural life of their schools, whānau, peer groups, and communities." The fifth commonality is transformation. Peacebuilding, as defined by Lisa Shirk in her book, The Little Book of Strategic Peacebuilding, seeks to prevent, reduce, transform, and help people recover from violence in all forms. John Paul Lederach also emphasizes that peacebuilding centrally involves the transformation of relationships. He wrote, "Sustainable reconciliation requires both structural and relational transformations." An example of transformation with music takes place in the West Eastern Divan Orchestra project. Barenboim made this observation. "What seemed extraordinary to me was how much ignorance there was about the other. The students were trying to do something together about which they were all passionate. Because they shared a common experience, they couldn't look at each other the same way again. I believe in cultural matters with literature and even better music, because it doesn't have to do with explicit ideas. If we foster this kind of contact, it can only help people feel nearer to each other." Two final important aspects of both peace building and music are healing and reconciliation. People cannot move away from violence towards peace if they cannot heal and find some sort of reconciliation from past trauma and injuries. Judy Atkinson, head of NIBI, the College of Indigenous Australian Peoples, uses music as a metaphor in the foreword to Ledrock's book, When Blood and Bones Cry Out. Healing is oral, and sound is not linear. Sound rises and falls in joy and sorrow, in loss and in triumph, in fear and in courage. John Paul and Angie Ledrock also express the role of music in healing. They write, based on sound, vibration, and rhythm, song and music provide a very different kind of medium and metaphor through which to explore healing. They are not reliant on linear modalities of making sense of things. Music touches the human experience. When we approach music and sound, we are dealing with a phenomena that penetrates the human experience, sonically and physically, in ways that go beyond words. Sound penetrates to a deeper level and can create the sensation of feeling held and surrounded. John Paul delves into three phenomena of music in relationship with reconciliation. The place of repetition and healing, the centrality of sound, nature, and beauty in locating a sense of humanity and self, and a sonic approach to the omnipresent challenge of time in process of healing. So I'd like to conclude this talk with a definition of peace by John Galtung, the principal founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies discipline. I believe the role of music in the instances I've just outlined clearly exemplifies these three qualities. Therefore, music, when used in a positive capacity, is indeed a useful tool to be considered by peace builders around the world. I was inspired and encouraged by the stories I heard from many New Zealanders about how music has played a role in peace building here in this country. I found it interesting that none of the people I interviewed intentionally chose to use music for this purpose. Peace building was just happened as a natural outgrowth of their interests, abilities, and sense of morality. So I return to my original question. Can music contribute to the very complex, often overwhelming, yet hopeful and sometimes life-giving world of peace building? My answer is a resounding yes. It already has, and it will continue to do so. I'd like to end this talk with a very simple premise that everyone can relate to no matter what your interests, vocation, or areas of expertise. Gandhi put it this way. If each one of us looks at how we deal with the moral precepts of honesty, forgiveness, gratitude, humility, tolerance, respect, and love for one another in our daily lives, we may be able to make a difference in moving towards a more peaceful world. Popular Japanese musician Shinji Harada, born in Hiroshima, follows the precept that peace begins with human kindness. He currently puts his efforts into composing songs for children based on themes of interpersonal harmony and love for nature. So after undertaking this research, I'm truly excited about the role music has played and can continue to play in peace building, both here, both in New Zealand and around the world. I'm resolved to build on past successes and to work towards a comprehensive role for music in peace and conflict issues in the future.
Thank you, Joan. I'm just curious if you have any practical ideas for how you might start using music in this way, maybe in the community?
Well, I actually am involved in a project with my Musica Harmonia group that Fred referred to. A book that Naima Bowie wrote, Mighty Be Our Powers, we commissioned a chamber music work based on that book, and Marty Eads wrote poetry. And so we feel that by combining music and literature and spreading the word about her efforts in building peace and especially empowering women is one way that we can do that. I think that there are, lots of other ideas. It's very different in New Zealand, where the Maori are really an integral part of the society. A lot of the signs, the language, a lot of people, use Maori words in everyday language, certainly street signs. It's different in different parts of the country. The North Island, South Island are slightly different. So they have a little bit different approach there. But I really do think the idea of bringing people together to work together, I have personally found that to be very helpful myself. If there's any conflict between somebody, just get together and do music, and those conflicts will just wash away. I just have lots of personal things. I think we need to encourage Also, the story about the young woman, when she grew up, she wasn't told she was Maori when she was a child, or she had any Maori heritage, because it was definitely looked down upon, and children were beaten for speaking Maori at school at a certain period in history. And so this young woman didn't know. So she didn't want to learn, she didn't want to sing because she was told she couldn't. And so I just think that making music, obviously a part of every child's life. And the other thing that I think is important, just to enable people to participate in music, not thinking that I can't do it or it needs to be left for others. But also in New Zealand, you definitely see a difference between the young people and the older people. I definitely heard racist comments from older people. But the youth, the children, are being taught the acceptance of Maori. I think from college age students on up, there is a real acceptance of everybody. And so I think gradually when new generations come on, there will be more acceptance of each other there in New Zealand. But you know, there are just so many problems all over the world with conflicts. In the United States, it's very different because, you know, Native Americans, we hardly hear anything. Very, very seldom do we hear much from them. They're often reservations. And so I think that once, if we can just do things more together and have those common experiences, I think that's one thing we need to work more towards. Yes, Roman.
You have a very interesting thesis that you're working with. I would be curious in your reflection, how does military music work in this whole scheme? Is there something different in that kind of music that maybe doesn't promote peace? What mm-hmm. is unique there?
Well, one of the people I interviewed actually was a graduate student at in the University of Otago Music Department whose specialty was bagpipe music. And the bagpipe music was written to get people excited to go to war. And so there are certainly, I mean, I read about the use of, you know, the negative use of music. I mean, from inciting people to violence, there's evidence today you can hear music by all kinds of negative groups that incite people to feel bad things as well. So music can be used, unfortunately, for the wrong purposes. In the military, you know, you think of Hitler, he used Wagner to try and get people to feel, you know, on his side, so to speak. So there are certainly just the emotions that music can rouse. It can be used in a negative way. There's no doubt about that. So we have to make sure that all of us who want peace are trying to promote music to be used in a very different way.
You spoke, I really appreciated your comments on music as narrative and meaning-making and so tied to identity in many instances. Is there a danger in kind of going along with this conversation in music solidifying so much an identity, and how does that factor into processes in conflict situations of bringing groups that have a purported very different identities together? Can music be used in terms of actual lyrics and content to dialogue with those other stronger musical traditions? Or what does the process, I guess, look like? What does the process look like in your research and experience in more, like, the stronger conflict areas of bringing groups together? And what types of music are used? Is it a mixing of both? Is it creating new music? And how, yeah, I guess that's my reflection, thinking about the identity aspect.
Well, it's a complicated topic, complicated question. It would depend on the context and I think the different situation. I mean, when the West Eastern Divan Orchestra was used, you know, the bringing together Palestinians and Israeli, they were both, though, raised on classical Western music. So you could use that common musical background to bring people together because they loved playing Beethoven, they loved playing, you know, Brahms, Mozart, that kind of thing. So they could sit side by side and have that kind of music be the kind of music that would bring them together. I did watch, there is a DVD about that orchestra, and at one point in time, there are two violinists that are sitting on the front stand. This is not a critique of violinists, but they could share a stand together and play beautifully, but when they would sit down and try to discuss issues, they couldn't do it. They weren't quite at that. One of them was open to discussing political issues, and the other one just got up and walked away. He wasn't there yet. So I think it does depend on the context. Obviously, you wouldn't want to, you know, come into an Ohio State football game and start singing the Michigan marching band. You know, that would just not go over well. So you have to be careful. One thing I can say is when I was in I did a tour of Taiwan back in 2004, my last sabbatical. I was in Taiwan for 3 weeks, and we were doing all American music. They wanted to hear American music, but we always concluded every concert by playing a Taiwanese folk song, and they just went crazy. They loved it when we were showing respect for their culture by playing a folk song of theirs. They came to hear American music, and we probably wouldn't have sold tickets if we hadn't done American music. But when we ended the concert by saying thank you to them by playing a piece from their culture, they respected that. So I think it really depends on. You'd have to, you know, very carefully know about the musical backgrounds. You certainly, you know, you'd have to be very aware of the setting and what you're doing with music, because you certainly could alienate and go the wrong direction. So, is that helpful?
Thank you, Joan. It's great to hear about your research. Some theorists talk about music playing a role in trauma healing. And I've often tried to think of the role that music has played in the Mennonite identity and Mennonite history. Did you connect that at all, sort of Mennonites as sort of this ethnic tribe, this group, and comparing that to the Maori, or do you do any analysis of the role of music in Mennonite history, particularly as it relates to trauma?
No, I really didn't look at that. I mean, I'm personally not coming from a Mennonite background myself, so I don't have quite the experience with it growing up. But since I've been here since 1996, I've certainly come to appreciate the hymn singing and the meaning of music to many Mennonites. And I've heard and read in books that Ken has written about the meaning of music in, you know, particularly difficult situations, that a hymn or something that somebody is familiar with. So I think that can happen in many instances, not just in the Mennonite world, but if there's music that you loved at some point in your life, that if you hear it again in a more difficult time, it can bring healing. I mean, there are stories Roman talked about in his biomedicine class recently about with people that are ill or have dementia or something, that music can bring them back to reality, bring them back to a sense of calm and peace. So I really didn't look at it particularly from the Mennonite world. Whereas, and there are very few Mennonites that I came across in New Zealand. I found one or two, but not many. I did attend a Quaker church briefly when I was in Dunedin, but that was as close as I got to a Mennonite church.
John, I think it's interesting that you describe the way that music really does help heal former traumas. And I'm reminded of how I'm reminded of the role that Pink Minnows play at Mennonite conventions every 2 years. And I remember very clearly, and this is, you know, my own very unprofessional observation, I remember very clearly that many years ago, the Pink Minnows sort of functioned as a group in there, and the interaction between the Pink Minnows and the rest of the biennium attendants was really fairly antagonistic. And as time progressed, and you know, time also evolved, and so there were changes in outlook as well. But one of the things that I think the Pink Minnows did so effectively is that they began to sing, and they began to sing Mennonite hymns. And it was shocking to me to see, even at this even at some of the more recent conventions, that in that way, the Pink Minnows, who formerly had been viewed as antagonistic, were able to extend the olive branch, and it was a wonderfully connecting event.
Yeah, it seems that would be an example of a commonality of music where they were seen as the other, but yet when they were able to offer this thing that they had in common, music, they were able to find common ground and let some of that antagonism disappear. So I think that's a wonderful use of music. So I think that, I really do think that music is, we don't think of that intentionally as a way to use music, but it just sort of comes out of our beings because it is a natural part of what we do. So yeah, thank you for that, Ian.
Well, this is just a comment more than a question, but two things about modern music and dance have really impressed me. One of them is the way they reinterpret what were historically warlike music and dance for peaceful, sometimes biblical purposes. It's just fascinating. And the other is the way they're proactively using music as a way to, for young people who are on a delinquent cycle, to reconnect them with their culture and identity and to bring them out of that cycle. Mm-hmm.
One thing that was in New Zealand is when you see the haka, you know, the war dance, I don't know if many Americans would have seen it who haven't been to New Zealand, but the rugby team always does it before they play. And it was, you know, started as something to be very scary and to ward off the other side, so to speak. But now it's become entertainment, and it's something that... That has definitely changed from what it was from its original use into something entirely different in today's society. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a really thought-provoking talk.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being here. See you again in the next one will be in January.